So the subject of our talk this evening, I am grateful to Father Hofer and Father Langevin for inviting me to speak to the student aid about the motto of our order, Veritas, our truth. What does it mean and how should we understand it? And what I would like to try to do is touch upon sort of three themes. The first is truth and being. The second is really about truth in the human person. How does the search for the truth integrate into our own development as persons? And then lastly, talk a little bit about supernatural truth and the vocation to be a seeker and in certain way, instrument of supernatural truth. I'm going to try to speak for about 35 minutes and then leave time for some questions. So you've heard, of course, of the doctrine of the transcendentals, and you know that St. Thomas is not the only one, but famously one of those who most poignantly formulated the idea that truth is coextensive with being, that everything that exists just insofar as it exists connotes properties of truth. And he reflects in the De Veritate, his great work on truth, in the first question, in the first article, in that masterpiece article, about the fact that all being has a certain knowability or intelligibility, and it's that property of being, of what is, insofar as it is, insofar as it's intelligible, knowable, that is what constitutes the foundation for truth, just like the appetibility or the desirability, that which can be loved in anything that exists, constitutes its, what we call its goodness, coextensive with being. Now, John of St. Thomas and other scholastics, following in the tradition of Thomas Aquinas' reflection, make sometimes a distinction that is controversial among Thomists, but interesting, between ontological truth and what can be called intentional or notional truth. That's just a nice little distinction to make at the beginning, even if you ultimately don't follow it, because it distinguishes between the reality itself, insofar as the reality in itself is true, the things outside of me, independently of whether I know them personally, have a certain truth by virtue of the fact that they exist, versus the intellectual perception of the reality, that I could be true in what I think, in my intentionality, in my notions, because what I think correlates rightly or is adequate to the external reality. So, you know, part of the challenge in life is to get the intentional or notional truth of the mind to line up with the ontological truth of reality. And we, as we know, it's a long struggle and battle, and it's part of what we try to do as human beings, and all human beings try to do. Now, I made reference here to the key idea of truth as adequation or adequatio, which is something that stems from Aristotle originally, as read by the scholastics and Aquinas in particular. It's in the Perihermeneos, or the On Interpretation of Aristotle, that he talks about the different ways in which human thought develops and where the whole issue of truth appears. And I'm sure all of you have heard and know well, but I'll recapitulate here, that there are three moments of intellectual knowing in the Aristotelio-Thomist tradition. There's first apprehension, and then there's judgment, and then there's reasoning. And it sounds very straightforward and schematically simple, but in fact it's kind of numinous and mysterious and interesting. And the three are like organic movements of the mind that presuppose each other and then maybe in a certain way mutate back into one another. And what I mean by it is this. We know the first operation of the intellect is to perceive or grasp intellectually something, the conceptual grasp. You walk into a room, you see something, you say, human being. Or over there, you say, camera. Okay, fine. You're making kind of an immediate apprehension of what the reality is. This is also what we do in math. There are three pencils on the table, or there are four people in the corner of the room sitting and talking. But then that initial conceptual grasp of reality, which is like a kind of intuition, it has developed in us, you know, through a complex matrix of sense impressions that and linguistic, you know, might say stimuli or inculcations or initiations of our parents. They were pointing at something in a book. You do this when you go over to your friend's house and they have little kids and you have to read to them in bedtime because your friends are like preparing dinner or whatever, and you get the book out and it's cueing the child. The two-year-old is making you read the book over and again, and it's got an animal. The animal has a color, and it, you know, maybe there's a fabric they touch, and it's trying to get the associations of the memory, sense memory, the internal senses to line up, so that the child then, it's basically Aristotelian education, is trying to get them to induce the conceptual universal through the medium of the conventional sense impressions. And they do it little by little. I mean, the intellect begins to secrete the conceptual formulations. Now, I mean, the educators haven't thought about that, but Aristotle saw it. And judgment then appears when the intellect can, as Aristotle says, compose and divide. You know, the simple case is, mama, there's a man. Mama, there's a car. Yeah. Or I hold up to the child, the hippopotamus, and I say, is this a horse? And they say, no. I say, what is it? It's a hippopotamus. So they also divide it. That is not a horse. Right. So our intellect is always trying to compose and divide and make more nuanced judgments, often very prudential ones. Will the student master give me permission to do this? If I ask the brother to help me with this, will he say yes or no, based on what I know about his character, his time schedule, et cetera, et cetera? You know, lots of nuanced judgments, or maybe very refined metaphysical judgments. What is it that I should understand rightly about the first angelic sin? How ought to I judge the motives of the first angelic sin? Very hard, you know, scholastic question. Beautiful, interesting, and terrifying. And then we reason. We reason through various kinds of syllogistic expressions of reason that allow us to go from A to B to C. I'm not very good at that. I tend to think intuitively, but we all know people who are rational. And the things all, though, really ally, don't they? Because once you begin to reason more carefully, it refines your judgments, and then you make better and better judgments. And then once you actually make a more incisive judgment, you begin to go back to apprehension. That's to say, there's more qualified apprehension. So, you know, do I think a human being has a spiritual soul? Never thought about it. Well, they're going to make me study it in seminary. Why didn't I think about it? Now I'm going to think about it. I'm going to actually reason about how it can be argued or demonstrated. And then I worked through the demonstration for half a year with Dr. Carl, and I realized, you know, it actually works, the argument, or for example, if you think it does. And then you've reasoned to make a new judgment, but then you look at human beings differently because you see there's evidence of rationality and intellectuality that shows that they're actually a spiritual creature with a free will and intellect that denotes that they're imago Dei. And so you get this enriched apprehension of reality. So truth appears in judgment. Judgment is in a certain way the perfection of the intellect and allows us to kind of make this adequate judgment that I have come to the truth about the thing. Man has a rational soul. God does exist. It's reasonable to think there are intrinsically evil acts, or it's reasonable to think there is such a thing as a mean between the extremes with regards to the virtue of temperance, a great discovery for many people. Then, of course, that then changes your character, stabilizes you in the way you relate to reality and to practical behavior. Now, I want to just make two qualifications before I pass on this point. Judgments are immensely powerful things when they're true. They have actually a huge attraction to the human person because innately people sense that it's the perfection of the intellect to make judgments. But they're also potentially dangerous. It is actually just a fact that the human intellect is in some ways frail because it's linked to the sensations and memory, and education passes through sociological customs and traditions, and things can get messed up and truths can be forgotten. So the intellect's naturally frail. Then you add in original sin, and then you add in ambient culture of skepticism, decades and centuries of skepticism with regards to the truth, capacity of the intellect to judge natural, supernatural, and even now natural truth. And you have what you get is a culture or a context in which people who have strong judgments are in some ways very attractive and in other ways very dangerous, because the human intellect has a kind of nostalgia for judgment or a yearning for judgment, but is often unable to make the judgment well. And so the more that your intellect is qualified to make good judgments, the more you have the capacity to actually help people, but also to abuse that power and manipulate people, especially if you work from a more voluntaristic conception of judgment, where you just kind of use your judgments to kind of move other people's wills instead of educating their minds. And of course, it's a temptation then our culture can also feel, I mean, if you look at the political power of people who make judgments, I mean, when you watch, and I'm not trying to be, he's always used an example, but I'm not trying to be actually kind of caricatural thing, but it's interesting to watch Adolf Hitler's speeches. I mean, just the mystique of his physical gestures and incredible potency of his speech and rhetoric, hypnotizing in some ways thousands of people at once. But I mean, what is he doing? It's one massive judgment after another in a culture of crisis. Right? So, I mean, it's just a good historical example of where ideology often is a strong judgment, that's a poor one, made in the face of a crisis of truth. Okay, so crisis about truth is an opportunity. It's also a danger. Being a person who makes judgments is you're able to help people. You're also able to scare people and sometimes to mislead people if you're not careful. So judgment is good. We need to aim for it. It's something we try to make. The more you make a great judgment about something, the more your moral authority grows objectively, whether it's perceived that way or not. And so making measured judgments and communicating measured judgments is part of a kind of what's called a pastoral zeal for the truth or a pastoral care for the truth, a cultural pastoral care for the truth in public, to make measured judgments. The other thing I just want to say is that idea that apprehension and judgment are kind of intermeshed at the end in the perfection is also the idea that judgment does terminate in contemplation in many ways. Like, when you make judgments about God, are you finished once you've made the right syllogistic determination? Or do you make the judgment in order to try to contemplate God? What's obvious? It's a rhetorical question in a way. But then think about Christ, a dogmatic judgment. Okay, I've read Chalcedon, Jesus is God, Jesus is truly man, one person. Okay, I've got my you know, the geometry of my Christology all lined up now. Right, so we go into chapel and all I do is I basically just decline the syllogisms. It's absurd, right? So, I mean, in a way, to have a qualified judgment about something that's mystical or just transcendent is to open yourself to more contemplative vulnerability, not less, normally. Now, if that's true for God and for Christ, it's also in a certain way true for every individual human being. You know, it's interesting how the demons in the New Testament say to Jesus, I know who you are. I know what you are. Right? You don't want to be that way with regards to a human person. We do want to know a lot about what a human person is so that we can help them, but we're still interpersonal in an I-you relationship, or some people call it, philosophers call it second-person relationship. And another human being is never dominable in the truth, even if you have a very strong engagement with them in the truth. It's always the judgment is always, in a certain way, a contemplative relationship to another personal being. And the person's always more than can be contained in a judgment. Now, God is truth, and this is, I'm going to pass from this kind of general metaphysical and epistemological reflection to kind of thinking about God particularly. All of reality can be known insofar as it is. So I propose this idea of ontological truth, which is the truth of the thing itself. But as I've also said from the beginning, the transcendental feature is that the reality has an intelligibility. So Lawrence Dewan, for example, wrote a very interesting article. I want to say it was in Novit Vetera some years ago, maybe 8 years ago or so, saying, look, you really shouldn't use this kind of notion of ontological truth because truth always implies a knower. So if you want to make the objection that, well, the reality still has a certain truth content to it, an intelligibility to it, independently of any of us knowing it, then he says you have to pass to a higher register, which is someone else knows it, who's God, the transcendent creator. But there has to be mind or intellect or knowledge for there to be truth, which is a nice, helpful transitional point. In Metaphysics, Book 2, Aristotle, in the Little Alpha book, Aristotle talks about, intimating the coextensivity of truth and being, the fact that what is most perfect or what is most ultimate in the order of being is that which is most true. He doesn't mention God there, but Aquinas, whenever he comments on that passage, or typically when he comments on that passage, comments on it being about God, and he uses it famously in the fourth way in Summa and many other places to talk about it. The principle itself leads you to the necessary conclusion of the existence of God. The idea is this: whatever is most real in the world, whatever is most real ultimately in reality, causally, so to speak, is that which is most true because it's the source or the foundation of the intelligibility of all the rest. So it's a very sort of simple but really vertiginous way of thinking about the fact that the kind of intelligibility of all things depend upon a first principle of what's most real. And if what's most real really is God, then God being most real, or the cause of the reality of all else, is himself the primary truth, because it's from his own being that everything else stems. It's from the intelligibility of what God is in himself that everything else takes on its intelligibility. That's not a totalitarian principle, as if understanding God as the first source of intelligibility would mean that all the other intelligibles have no real integrity. They're just sort of ontological dust, and they're just sort of, you know, something you pass through to get to the monolithic, unique reality of God. That's the contrary, is the truth, is that God has really given them the density of being that's intelligible as a kind of expression of the transcendent intelligibility of what God is in himself. And we know God only imperfectly and indirectly, as it were, through the veil of his creatures, which signify imperfectly but really something of what God is in himself. Now, when he gets to book 12 in the Metaphysics, Aristotle comes to that wonderful enunciation of the principle, which no one had said, I think, before him, which is that God is thought thinking itself, that there's this vitality of eternal knowledge that constitutes what God is. So it's not just that God is intelligible in his very being, which was my first point there, but that God is an act of knowledge, and that God is the object of his own knowledge, that eternally God knows himself and is this act of self-knowledge. Aquinas in the Prima Pars of the Summa will talk about God being the knower, the act of knowledge, and the object of the knowledge. So what in us are three distinct things are in some way in God one mystery, that we are a knower knowing something else through the medium of our act of knowing, but God is eternally the act of knowing or contemplating himself, or subsistent contemplation, the contemplation of the contemplation, the knowledge of knowledge, who's in the first in the order of reality. We don't, you can't convey that in a psychological experience or even in a rational model of reality. We don't have any kind of direct understanding of it. We can say that it's true by analogy without really grasping it. And, of course, in the Christian revelation, what we understand is that that eternal act in which God knows himself from all eternity is also an act in which knowing himself, the Father, in beholding or contemplating his own subsistent wisdom, eternally generates the verbum, or the logos, the word, in which he expresses the whole of the truth of what he is as God in his begotten Son, who is one in being with him. So there are analogies between the generation of the word from the Father to a human act of knowing, and there are many disanalogies. But we can say that the subsistent contemplation that is God is Trinitarian, that there is from the Father the eternal Son, in whom he expresses the fullness of the contemplation of his life, and from whom and with whom the Spirit is spirated as the eternal Spirit of truth, which is this spirated person who is love, who comes forth from God's eternal act of self-knowledge. From God's eternal act of self-knowledge comes forth the Word. From the Word and the Father's eternal act of self-love comes forth the spirated Spirit. And that mystery, deeply veiled from us, but nevertheless manifest to us in Christ, is the ultimate reality toward which the human person and the whole human race is on pilgrimage toward. And that God creates in the truth so that all things that come to be through him who was in the beginning, the Word, who embodies and bears in himself, you might say, the fullness of the truth of God. I am the truth, the way, and the life. He who is one with the Father. Before Abraham was, I am. That he who has come forward into the world is he through whom the world was made. The light that was from before the dawn of creation, the light of truth that's in the Father's bosom from all eternity, has taken on flesh and revealed to us the mystery of who God is. That light created the world, and that light is now in the world. I'm going to return a little bit to Christ in the last part of the talk. Now, that was the longest part of the talk, to kind of give a sort of metaphysical background to it that's theistic and Trinitarian. But now I want to talk a little bit about the human being made for the truth. Uh, I won't want to start so much in the genetic order of looking at how a human being develops, but think more about the ultimate order. What is the ultimate sort of purpose of the human being as a knower? Well, we know that from Revelation, but we can also say, if you follow the thinking of someone like Aristotle or Aquinas, from philosophy too, that the human being is ultimately made for contemplation. Now, this is not a popular idea in our world today. The closest common view of this you would find in, say, I think the popularity of television, because television is a kind of passive receptive contemplation of a very low order. And I partake in it myself occasionally. I'm not casting the first stone. But I don't think we need to, I think it does say a lot about the culture that it's really kind of through the visual activities of the phantasms. I mean, we haven't really progressed very far from Plato's cave. If anything, our culture is doing a lot to confirm the sort of poignancy of that brilliant metaphor of man in the cave who only perceive the forms of truth through the medium of the sense apparitions and really don't look at who's wielding the camera. Okay. But that being said, the fact that the idea is not that popular, it does have manifestations. When people fall in love, they sort of stare at each other. It can be, of course, more like lust or romantic love. But, I mean, to the extent that people really become deeply fascinated with one another, there's a way in which they realize that they can't really dominate or understand or dismiss the other person because the other person has in some way become their good. And at the same time, they want to study the other person. That's a lower form of contemplation, and then you have the higher contemplation of the arts. But it really is when the mind moves towards metaphysical reality and philosophical contemplation and theological contemplation. And really the most popular form of high contemplation is that one of the ones that's the highest, which is Eucharistic and Christological. And that's made possible because of the sacraments. That you see the restorative feature of the liturgy of the economy of salvation. God became human and established the church and the Eucharist to kind of heal us, to bring. Bernard of Clairvaux says this, you know, he became flesh so that we would be drawn out of the flesh to contemplate the things of the spiritual life. And the Eucharist has that healing effect of bringing us into an ambit of contemplation, which is anticipatory of our union with God, wherein we know we're promised that if we are faithful to Christ in faith, hope, and charity, and in conceding our whole life to him in mercy, we can attain by grace to the beatific vision and see God face to face. The dignity of the person is to seek the truth, to seek the truth about the human person, about the world, about God, and supernatural truth in order to become a contemplative, in order to become a person who contemplates. There are a lot of different ways in which the mind can work to have a contemplative vocation. We shouldn't necessarily think just about, say, contemplative nuns or monks. There's a lot of ways to kind of live out that vocation to contemplation, but it is our common human destiny and calling. And it helps develop love. When you know something better, you may love it more. And if you know it rightly, you can love it well. And this is especially true of human persons. It's even more true in a way of God, and particularly of God as known through the medium of supernatural revelation. Knowledge can inflame the heart. It can lead us into a deeper love of persons. And it can help us love people more truthfully and responsibly. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more in a moment. Truth is at the heart of religion. One of the kind of deep crises of our civilization is the crisis of trust in any form of religion. I don't know exactly what people mean when they say organized religion, but I guess they mean religion with some kind of collective features of belief and practice. Liturgical corporate form. But, you know, the deeper skepticism about the possibility of public religious commitment is based really fundamentally on a crisis about religious truth. And so being a truth seeker in the context of religion is particularly important for the future of promoting religion in a culture where there's often a fairly high degree of a priori skepticism. Right, so we need to be persons of the truth in the way we live out our vocation to be people that are religious and the people who acquire the virtue of religion. Now, the search for the truth is also not just about our relationship with God through contemplation, through love of God, through religion, but it's also about our relationship to ourself. We develop a deep personal vitality and autonomy through the search for the truth. It's been said that the intellect is what is most alive in the human person. The intellect is, because the agent intellect, always going. Your sleep, senses are dormant, but, you know, in your dreams, maybe some of you don't remember them, but, you know, your mind is actually working. It may be working on crazy things, but the vitality of the agent intellect is going, right? In some ways, the agent intellect never sleeps. It's the light that always stays on. And so this is vitality in the mind that's just, you know, working and laboring, and it can grow. I mean, the intellect, you think about, we started as an embryo. We started as an embryo, and then we were like, we were one of those tiny people. It wasn't that long ago. And then we were an adolescent, and our passions basically dominated us to a very unhealthy degree, usually. And, you know, then we were an undergraduate, and, like, the concepts started waking up, but, like, not really, you know, there's a lot of clouds. You know, and as you go on in life, you know, the intellect keeps developing. Now, it's true, there's, like, the impasses of senility and the phantasms. The phantasms of the brain, and as you get older, your memory gets weaker. But all your life, you can actually develop in a trajectory towards a deeper and deeper grasp of the truth. And this, if this becomes a lodestar of your development of your person, you acquire a great deal of autonomy. You're not a relationally dependent person in an overly negative way. You have a kind of intellectual vitality to be oriented toward reality. Which doesn't mean that you're autonomous in the sense that you think you don't need anybody. That's not a truthful position. I don't need friends. I have the truth. That's not the same thing as the truth and my friend I love both, but the truth more, which Aristotle famously said of Plato. That is true. Right, but the search for the truth actually leads to the deepest forms of friendship. There's no greater friendship than the friendship between those who seek the truth. The philosophical friendship for Aristotle, I think we'd have to say now the theological friendship, and the mystical friendship of those who seek to live the truth of Christ. That's why, in a certain way, religious life, even though we live with people that we might not have chosen to live with, but people Jesus chose us to live with, and Jesus doesn't have the same taste as us, is nevertheless a great foundation for friendship, because despite all the incredible differences of temperament and the trial that they represent, we do actually share in common with the other brother in religion the sort of deepest inclination of life toward the truth and towards truth of union with Christ. And also, it's very important, the search for the truth in relationship to understanding the other person. You know, God, the self, and the other person. Aristotle says, when he defines friendship, that he's talking about it. What do you love in the friend, in friendship according to virtue, not friendship just according to pleasure or utilitarian good, you know, usefulness, but friendship according to virtue. And he says, well, you love the other person in what he or she is for his or her own sake. It's a kind of a mixture where you want the other person to flourish and to be his or her best self, and you delight in the person who that person is. Right, so in that person being their best self, you also find delight because you partake of the kind of the radiance of the qualities of that person or the flourishing of the qualities of that person. It doesn't have to be emotionally ecstatic. This can be calm, spiritual agreeableness. But you find it agreeable. It's not God. It's just another human person. But it's agreeable that the person is flourishing in a certain way and delightful in a certain way. There are plenty of things about all of us that are not delightful to other people. But there are plenty of qualities in each human person that can be delightful to another person. And to not be able to see those is a lack of intelligence on our part. Always. And we have that blindness. Now, friendship can blossom when there really is justice. Aristotle says as a foundation, it's a sine qua non condition, not a sufficient condition. But when there is a sufficient amount of justice, I'm able to respect what the other person is and what's due to them with a sufficient humility on my part and a certain welcoming of what they are, but also with a sufficient requirement, you might say, of welcoming and humility on the part of the other, that the other person can accept that I exist, that I have qualities. I didn't author myself. God made me. I have to exist. I can't, you know, suicide's a grave sin, so, you know, we have to work together here. And that means, that does mean I should try to curb some of the things in my personality that are particularly, you know, poignantly distressing to you, but it also, and you should do the same for me, but it also means, like, we have to welcome each other's distinct qualities. And there is always a quality to the other person that I don't have, or some modality of what it means to be human, a kind of modal realization of human nature, because we have the same human nature, each of us, but there's a modal realization of it that's absolutely unique to each human being. Each one is a human existent in whom esse takes on a particular configuration, a certain modal realization of the essence of what it means to be human. And this can lead to a virtuous cycle of friendship where my capacity to recognize the good in another person and to respond to it helps them love themselves. And when they are able better to love themselves, they're able to then appreciate and reciprocate that care for their good by in turn loving the person who loved them. And when they can love what's good in us, they help us love ourselves. And when we love ourselves, we're more autonomous in being able to love other people. You do this all the time in pastoral work. If you're kind of figuring out what you're doing, you try to tell the person their qualities, actually. One of the effects of original sin is they love a lot of the wrong things, they love themselves badly, but they also don't love themselves. And to acknowledge their qualities is part of realism and humility. So being able to give of ourselves by telling other people their qualities, and then the priest in a certain way has to always be Aristotle's magnanimous man, in the sense that he has to want to kind of tell other people the good that's in them and help them without needing them. Because if he starts to need the people because he's always in a relationship of inequality with them, so if he starts to need them for his own good, that can be dangerous. That's different than the relationship between the priest and other priests. Priests need friendship among each other. That's why you need friends in religious life who support you. You can have some friendships outside of religious life with people who are kind of support you and help you, but it's not definitely, usually not good to have friendships in which you depend, kind of, you might say, personally, emotionally, and existentially upon people you minister to. So in a certain way, you have to be the magnanimous man. But that doesn't mean that this rule doesn't apply. It just means that it applies, and you're poorer with regards to need. To be magnanimous and to be poor or strangely connected, you're poorer with regards to wanting or needing their affirmation. You know, your own sense of your own well-being, it's enough to be a priest. If you're a priest, you can love yourself. You know, and if you're a religious brother, you can love yourself. You've taken vows and given God the most ultimate gift that a human being can give anything or anyone. Right? So to be a religious man who's made vows, to be a person who's ordained in the person of Christ, you have a sufficient grounds to live in friendship with others like yourself, and then from that to be a giver. But you still need to be seeking the truth of the other person to tell them the good about themselves, and not lies, not false flatteries, but also to help them to see their real qualities. Let me say a last word here about a little bit about a word about supernatural truth. Grace is given to the human being in more than just the intellect, or in more than just the enlightenment of faith and even vision. It's also given into the heart. It's given into the body. In this life, more through charismatic graces, in the world to come through resurrection from the dead. But, that being said, grace is given to the intellect as truth. God reveals himself to us as the first truth who's veiled from us by the creatures of this world, speaks into the darkness of our intellect and brings us the light of Christ, which we carry symbolically in the symbol of the candle on Easter night as a kind of core image of the difference Christ makes to all humanity. We who are in the tomb of darkness in this chapel without the real presence of God among us bring in the light of Christ, symbolized by the Paschal candle, and the universe goes from being a universe of darkness into a universe of illumination. The mind is now made able to cross the great barrier of transcendence and embrace the intimate knowledge of who God is in himself, who comes to us also in the truth of the Eucharistic sacrifice in that same ceremony, and enlightens our mind and feeds our mind with the bread of truth. We nourish our contemplation from eating the body and blood of Christ, which enlighten our human intellect. So this gives rise to the possibility not just of the contemplation of God or the love of God or the religion that is true religion, the Catholic religion, the one true religion, but it also gives rise to the possibility of a unique way of life. That's to say, a way of life of men and women who devote themselves uniquely to the pursuit and to the transmission of the supernatural truth of God out of love, in devotion to the, to be devoted to the search for the truth, the supernatural and natural truth God has communicated to us, that we might spend our entire life not simply seeking to possess the truth, but even more deeply seeking to be possessed by the truth through the love of the supernatural truth of Christ, and to become the instrumental communicators of his truth. And to be an order of preachers who communicate the truth of Christ to the world, who seek his truth as his mendicant beggars, who beg him for the truth, who want to find that truth through study and prayer and contemplation, and who want to articulate the fruits of that contemplation to others through the communication of sacred truth. St. Dominic has that wonderful originality in the history of the Church to have found a way to connect or fuse together mendicancy or poverty of spirit with the search for the truth, that he should that he might become poor to contemplate the mysteries of Christ and receive the grace to preach with sermo sapientiae, the grace of the wisdom of the word, to preach the mysteries of Christ to others, to become a mendicant for the truth, and that God would both inspire and then answer that calling. This means that we are, in the order, men of the doctrine of the Church. It's a huge mistake to think that this is true only of a certain modality of Dominican life, say, seminary professors or people who write. The doctrine of the Church is, in a certain way, made most real when its doctrina, it means teaching. When the teaching of Christ is communicated to people in the most intimate circumstances of their life, from the pulpit, in the confessional, at the bedside when people are dying in the hospital, in the middle of someone's living room, at the heart of the crises of their life, but also when they're open and vulnerable to real teaching and instruction, that we should be men of wisdom who communicate the teaching of Christ and convey that truth of Christ instrumentally through the things that we preach and teach, and through our good counsel of prudent counsel to human beings. And this is the last couple of points, it has to be mirrored in the truth of our lives. To be men of the doctrine of the Church and preachers of grace, preachers of the truth of Christ, we have to aim to have our life be lives of truth, right? To live in conformity with the mystery that is Christ. Now, part of that is being sinners. And, I mean, because it says in the first letter of John, if you say you have no sin in you, you are a liar. So being a man of the truth is to say, well, I have sin in me, and I come to Christ in embracing the truth of his mercy. And because I can embrace his mercy, I have the strength to stand, so to speak, in his presence and seek the truth. But it's also about conformity of our lives to his life and of our minds and hearts to his truth. And this is, of course, of so great importance today, that the world doesn't just need prophets or teachers. It needs witnesses. To be a witness to the truth is to be a person who not only communicates the saving doctrine of Christ, the truth of Christ, but a person who lives the truth of Christ. And when you live the truth of Christ in your life and you teach it with intelligence and elegance, nothing can stand up to that. That is a light that will pierce minds and move hearts and liberate human beings, because it really is the integral connection between the beauty of the truth of Christ and the witness of the love of Christ lived out in one's life. We are men dedicated to the Virgin Mary, who is the mother of the truth incarnate, and Catherine of Siena has that incredible passage in the Dialogues where she talks about God calling Dominic to take up the mantle of the Word, to take on the mantle of the Word, and says that the Virgin Mary herself founded the order of preachers so that Dominic could take up the mantle of the Word and bring the truth of her Son out into the world. So this is a beautiful idea, that the Virgin Mary cares intimately, cares profoundly about our ongoing mission to bring the truth of her Son out into the world, that she abides with us and intercedes for us, that we might study fervently the truth of the sacred mystery and communicate it with reverence and love to the whole world. Thank you very much. So should we take questions. 10 minutes for questions or so?
Questions?
Paul, you mentioned that the contemplative life is not just for contemplatives. So in reality, though, how do you counsel people who live in the world towards that end?
People who live in the world or people who live in the mixed life of friars? You mean
in the world? And for friars.
Well, I think with lay persons, it depends. It is a. This is one of the great advantages of the religious state of life. I mean, there is a reason that our life is in a certain way, the easier way of life. I mean, Paul says, I would counsel you to do to live as I am if you want to be happier. And he says, the married man is concerned about the things that go on in the world. He has many worries and struggles. And I say often to lay people, I don't think that the vocation to sanctification in the lay state necessarily entails the promise that God will give you meaningful work. Because often, of course, baptized people want to live a very profound, meaningful life, and they want that to be reflected in their day-to-day paid work. And often their paid work is laborious, monotonous. Maybe they have an employer who's not very compassionate, or even, you know, maybe somewhat vitiated. So you have huge stresses of people in terms of their work life. And, of course, raising children is a huge grace and gift to people, at least a natural grace, but it's not a stress-free enterprise. And it's all-consuming. The child depends on you entirely, always. So I think you have to be realistic and not try to romanticize. Their sanctification passes through obedience to their concrete state. And if they can carve out 30 minutes for silent prayer or for Mass or for both each day, they're doing well. If they're single, they might be able to pray the office. If they can go to Eucharistic adoration, once they start going to Eucharistic adoration regularly, they often start thinking about the religious life. But if they can take up, you know, I think you have to see what's realistic. But they need mental prayer. I think you need to be able to tell people about sort of what does it mean to build up a habit of mental prayer. And usually in the presence of the Eucharist, if possible, if not, then through Lectio Divina. And what is it to use the Bible in a contemplative manner to try to contemplate Christ through His words, through the teachings of the New Testament? Okay. Yes.
Thanks. You spoke about telling the truth to people about the goodness in them, which is obviously we all know people who don't love themselves enough. How do you deal pastorally with people who love themselves too much, or in a twisted way?
Yeah. Well, we all do.
Right.
I think it is necessary sometimes to tell people gently where they are bound by certain inclinations of vice. This is obviously what Augustine talks about in terms of fraternal correction, and it's a charity. Now, first of all, for oneself, I think I'm not trying to encourage everybody in the room. I'm certainly not trying to encourage you to all come to me. But I think when a brother comes to us and tells us something that, you know, we have an issue that we need to confront, I was always taught that the first response should be to thank the brother, because it takes a tremendous amount of courage. Now, obviously, there's a tactful and human way to do that, and there's a way that's epistemologically humble. Like, it seems to me that, you know. But I do think that the search for the truth about oneself and one's own faults is really hard and really necessary, and part of sanctification. It's part of the way we go to confession. It should be part of the way we teach people to go to confession, not to worry too much about the priest, but to worry about going after themselves, not in the sense of self-detestation, but in the sense of being thorough and really trying to open their soul to the truth. And I think it's important sometimes to confront people pastorally. Especially, there are different priests have different approaches. Some are more blunt. I think I'm softer than most, but what I tend to try to do is wait till the person shows some some awareness or some reference to the problem, and then to push a little bit, and sometimes to name it. And if you put a name on a vice, you know, to identify it and say this is something. And I think if people think that you love them or that you basically care about them, then they're much more willing to receive the truth from you. And sometimes it's only after a time that you... And without trust, it's very hard to practice fraternal correction. When there's no trust in religious life or not sufficient trust, when there's not sufficient trust in a pastoral engagement, it's very hard to communicate truth about the vices of another person, both because you have trouble doing it with real care for the person, and they have trouble believing you care about them. All right, so. Another question.
Well, you had said you were going to talk about the mixed life.
Well, I mean, I think we have. I think you know. I don't think. I think I'm probably more of a model of what not to do than what to do in this respect. But I do think that. I mean, choral office observance in choral office is certainly a important foundation for maintaining a kind of the primacy of the contemplative life. But it's certainly not sufficient. I think even more important in some ways is mental prayer. And I admire people who can do their half hour or maybe more ideally 45 minutes to an hour of mental prayer a day in the afternoon. I'll be honest, I find it's pretty dubious when people always do it at night, but you know, that better to do it at night than not to do it. But I think it's always preferable to do it in the morning, because in the long run, after 10 a.m., if you're a priest and you've been ordained at least 2 years, your life will never be your own again. It just gets more every year. And that's not true of just one person. That's true of everybody. You get devoured. So if you can pray sometime for a serious chunk of your day before 10 a.m. in the morning. And I think the other thing that we tend to lose in our activist style of being American Dominicans is contemplative study. It's very hard to study gratuitously for the sake of the love of the truth. Now, what sometimes saves us is we study because we have to talk about something that we don't know enough about. And that can help you in the parish. You know, you have to sometimes give a class on something you don't know enough about, so you go and read. But I do think keeping your mind, you become, in a certain way, you become what you think about. People say you become what you love, you become what you spend time doing. You also become what you think about. I mean, quite literally, the intellect assimilates the intelligible form of the reality you consider. So if you spend a lot of time thinking about, like, the metaphysics, or if you the metaphysical side of reality, or you spend a lot of metaphysical depths of reality, I should say, or the sacred mysteries, then you, in a certain way, live, you dwell in those mysteries. That's what you love. That's what you are. And that's hard. There's a part, and you know, look, it's also about men who are celibate and are going to die. We want to build buildings, we want to build monuments, we want to have we want to do something. But you know, maybe people want to have children. They want their children to go to Harvard. They want their children who goes to Harvard to become a Supreme Court lawyer. They want themselves to become the President of the United States. We all want like legends of immortality. And I think that just seeking the truth for its own sake and becoming a kind of a poor man for the truth is contrary to a lot of our inclinations in the face of kind of the temptations of worldliness and as a reaction to our mortality. But I think it's actually preparation for immortality of the real kind, of living with God for eternity, to seek the truth of God in all things, in philosophically, biblically, historically, scientifically, intellectually. That, I think, keeps us a little bit aiming toward contemplation, in fact. Yes,
Constance. You talked about the religious as a sign. Is there a way where you could say that sort of progressing in knowledge, you not only possess more truth, but you become like a religious, the moral man becomes more of an object of truth? That the moral life would present you more as a source of guidance or
yeah, I mean, we're you know the saying that we're not only called to witness to the truth, but also to shine and illuminate. I think the spirit of my comments was conveying that, you know, in a certain way, to be an instrument of the truth, that's another kind of subtle thing. On the one hand, in a world where there is so little doctrinal love of Christ as the truth. I really think there is. There's very little love of Christ as the truth and the doctrinal truth of Christ in our world today. In a way, you have the responsibility to be a communicator of the truth. And one of the things we always think is, well, you know, I didn't win the Nobel Prize for theology, and I don't know if I have the final say on this, but I better still go. But, you know, the point is,
we're in an army where, you know, we're waiting, we're often thinking that some general needs to come and really deal with this truth question. But we're increasingly in a world where there are no colonels, captains, or generals. There's just you and me, foot soldiers on the front line with no cavalry coming. And so when that's the case, you have to communicate the doctrine of the church. There's nobody else going to show up. And I can tell you, after the formation you get here, don't be waiting for somebody who has a little bit more theology than you. I mean, sometimes it's true that there are, and we need to consult an expert, especially in like a subtle canonical bioethical case, whatever. And we can be arrogant, and it's a danger. But we do have to take on the response. We have a heavy burden as Dominicans to communicate the truth, and at the same time, not to capture people, right? I mean, we want to liberate people, and like I was saying about the autonomy of the truth, we want to bring people to a place where they're more autonomous. I think the true master of philosophy or theology is a person who wants the student to become more autonomous increasingly and become more themselves, but more increasingly dependent on the truth. I mean, that's really, we gain our autonomy vis-a-vis other things that are secondary by being more and more uniquely dependent on the truth. So I'm agreeing with you, and I'm saying I think it's a kind of an interesting paradox to enlighten others, to enliven others, and how to bring them into that dynamic movement toward life and the communication of the light.
Nick, we're going to have to wrap things up at this point, but thank you very much, Father Thomas Joseph. Certainly, we can continue the conversation. Are you coming downstairs?